Welcome to the Seattle Public Library's podcasts of author readings and library events, a series of readings, performances, lectures, and discussions. Library podcasts are brought to you by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation. To learn more about our programs and podcasts, visit our website at www.spl.org. To learn how you can help the Library Foundation support the Seattle Public Library, go to foundation.spl.org. Good evening. I'm Chris Higashi, Program Manager of the Washington Center for the Book at the Seattle Public Library. Welcome to tonight's event with Thomas Ricks. We first thank Elliott Bay Book Company for inviting us to co-present this evening, the Seattle Times for generous promotional support for library programs, our author series sponsor, Gary Kunis, and finally, this event is supported by the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Okay, so here's Casey O'Neill from Elliott Bay Book Company to introduce our special guest. Thanks.
All right, good evening and welcome. I'd like to thank Chris and our sponsors, co-presenters, and partners here at the Seattle Public Library. And I'd like to thank all of you for joining us tonight. Tonight, the Elliott Bay Book Company is very pleased to welcome Thomas Ricks back to Seattle. We were fortunate enough to have him here for his two most recent previous books, and we're very grateful to have him here tonight with his newest book, The Generals, released just a few weeks ago, and it is a book that has only become more relevant since its publication. Thomas Ricks is a senior fellow at the Center for a New American Security. He is a contributing editor to Foreign Policy Magazine, where his blog, The Best Defense, his daily blog, The Best Defense, can be found. For 17 years, he covered the U.S. military for the Wall Street Journal, after which he worked the same beat for the Washington Post from 2000 to 2008. He's been a part of two Pulitzer Prize-winning teams, and he has reported on the U.S. military from Somalia, Haiti, Kosovo, Bosnia, Macedonia, Kuwait, Turkey, Afghanistan, and Iraq. He is the author of four previous books, including Making the Corps and a novel, A Soldier's Duty. More recently, 2007's Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, one of the first and most critical and most influential books on the Iraq War, followed by 2009's The Gamble, General Petraeus and the American Military Adventure in Iraq. He's here tonight with The Generals, American Military Command from World War II to Today, where most accounts of warfare center around one conflict where the military leadership is a small part of that larger narrative. Here, the generals are the narrative. It is a remarkable book about what has changed at the top of American military leadership in the last 60 years, what has been increasingly valued and devalued, what has been increasingly encouraged and discouraged, and ultimately what has been become acceptable and unacceptable. Reality that we're all very much still in the middle of, as anyone who's opened a newspaper in the last 2 weeks is well aware of. And here, Thomas Ricks, as in his other previous work, remains focused on the enormous consequences and costs of this reality, most importantly for the soldiers and civilians for whom military leadership is a life and death matter. So we're honored to have him here with us. Please join me in welcoming Thomas Ricks.
Thanks very much for that nice introduction. Can you all hear me up in the cheap seats? Good job. Okay. The generals. I love this 15-foot-high banner. It's like being on the Jon Stewart show, where it's right behind you. I thought I'd talk tonight for about 20 minutes about the book and then get into your questions, which actually I find the more enjoyable and interesting part of the evening. This book began for me in an unusual way. Sometimes books kind of come about kind of hazily. You're not sure. You eventually focus on it. Sometimes I'll find myself reading or studying and thinking for something for several months before I realize, oh, that's the book I'm thinking about. This was totally different. I can tell you the exact place and moment in which I conceived this book. I was in Sicily on a staff ride, which is when you go out and walk a battlefield using documents from the battle looking at information available to commanders at the time, thinking about the decisions they made and discussing it with other people. And we were in central Sicily at one of the highest points of that wonderful island, and we were talking about the Battle of Troina, the culminating battle of the August 1943 campaign that many of you know from the movie Patton. Patton, Montgomery, and so on. At the end of the Battle of Troina, Terry Allen, the commander in the battle, the American commander, and the commander of the 1st Infantry Division, one of our most successful commanders in the first year of the war, Terry Allen was fired. And I was standing there slack-jawed. I have just come out of Iraq. This is 2005. And I said, wait a second, Terry D. LaMesa Allen, commander of the Big One, Red One, 1st Infantry Division, commands well and aggressively in Africa and then in Sicily, and he got fired? I didn't know that. And it struck me so much because in Iraq, nobody was getting fired for anything. Mediocrity was a core value there. How could one of the most successful generals we had be fired in World War II, yet nobody be fired in Iraq? In the same army, same country, a lot of the same traditions. And that's the thread with which this book began. And I began pulling on the thread and pulling on it. And it led me back to George Marshall, who I think should be better known. If remembered at all today, George Marshall is remembered for the Marshall Plan, which he didn't even do as a soldier. He did as Secretary of State. George Marshall was Chief of Staff of the Army from 1939 to 1945. He was appointed Chief of Staff, he became Chief of Staff, took office on September 1, 1939. Quite a day in American and world history. He was picked for the job by Franklin Delano Roosevelt for an unusual quality. He had a habit of speaking truth to power. Roosevelt was a Machiavellian man and a manipulative man, and he was so good at manipulating and intimidating people, he knew he needed somebody who wouldn't put up with that BS, who actually could cut through it. George Marshall had not been the natural pick to be Army Chief of Staff. The more likely candidate had been a general named Hugh Drum, remembered now only because Fort Drum, New York, is named after him. But Roosevelt liked this Brigadier General Marshall, who kind of stood up to him. In one meeting in 1938, at the end of the meeting, Roosevelt said rather airily, "Isn't that right, George?" This is in the Oval Office. Marshall first makes clear that his name is General Marshall, not George. He resents it because he thinks it misrepresents their relationship, that he's not a friend. He is a loyal subordinate and a professional. And he says, "Actually, no, sir, I disagree." And Roosevelt's kind of startled. Everybody else in the room has been manipulated into agreeing with me. What's your problem? It happens again, May 13, 1940, as the Germans are slicing into the French, the spring invasion of France in World War II. There's a meeting about building 10,000 aircraft, and Roosevelt, again, rather airily says, "Well, okay, we're all agreed." And Marshall says, "No, we're not." And again says, "This is what, you've got this wrong, you don't understand." And he actually says, "Mr. President, if you don't do something right now, I don't know what's going to happen to this country and the world." And it was remembered by other members of the administration at the day that Roosevelt really started thinking differently about the military machine and what would be needed if we got involved in World War II. But what is most striking to me about Marshall is the way he ran the military in World War II. On the day he took office, the Army, which included the Air Force, was about 185,000 people. When he stepped down in 1945, it was about 8.5 million people. And he made it look almost easy, the way he managed it, the way he managed this growth. If I had to summarize the way that Marshall ran the Army in World War II, I would use one word: accountability. Reward success, punish failure, promote promising people. It was too important to care about officers' feelings, about officers' careers. The needs of the enlisted men come first, and the needs of the nation have top priority always. The officer corps comes third, and we'll tell you, as we'll see later, this was not always the case. In World War II, 155 men commanded Army divisions in combat. Of those 155 men, 16 were relieved for combat inefficiency, for not being good leaders. But it was forgiving. Of the 16 relieved, 5 received command of other divisions in combat later in the war. Many other generals, though, were just shipped back to the United States to do things like training jobs. The bottom line is in World War II, generals had about 90 days to be effective, get killed, or get moved out. Accountability. Here's a trivia question for you, and don't worry if you don't know the answer. I've asked military audiences, and they don't know either. Does anybody know who Major General James Cheney is? Major General James Cheney, spelled C-H-A-N-E-Y. He was Dwight Eisenhower's predecessor as the American commander in Europe. He was moved out of London by Marshall and wound up World War II commanding a boot camp in Wichita Falls. In the place of the Cheneys, the Fredendalls, the older soldiers, generals who were relieved, rose up younger men. We don't know the name of Cheney. Many people don't, most people wouldn't know the name of Lloyd Fredendall, another top general fired. But we do know names like James Gavin, Matthew Ridgway, and most of all, Dwight Eisenhower. At the beginning of 1940, Dwight Eisenhower was a lieutenant colonel. He was executive officer of an infantry regiment based not far from here, Vancouver, Washington. Marshall thought a long time about what he might need in the coming war. It wasn't just sort of randomly who's the next guy in line. Marshall long had thought that we had two basic requirements going into any big war. Number one, we were a big democracy protected by or isolated by oceans, so we would go to war unprepared. And that meant we would suffer demoralizing defeats at the beginning of any big war. So he wanted determined, optimistic, cheerful people to lead his army. Second, he said, if we're in a war, it's going to be overseas, which means we're going to be fighting alongside allies. I need someone who can cooperate with allies, who's not going to get in fights with them, yet still has the nerve and the steel to defend our interests as necessary. Looking at these qualities, he promoted up several people, giving them a chance. One of them, Dwight D. Eisenhower. So by the time of Pearl Harbor, December 7, 1941, Dwight Eisenhower was a newly promoted brigadier general. 5 days after Pearl Harbor, December 12th, he's at Fort Sam Houston, down outside San Antonio, Texas, and his phone rings. Ike, says the voice on the other end of the line. The chief of staff says, get up here to Washington. His heart sinks. Oh, no, he thinks. I sat out World War I. I never got to France. And now I'm going to get called to Washington to be a staff officer again. But he says, okay, he's not going to complain. He tries to get on the Blue Bonnet Express, the express train eastward, but it's already left. The planes are grounded because the weather's so bad, but he commandeers a little army plane, and they fly at 30 feet across Texas, following the railroad tracks, till they catch up with the plane. Then they signal, catch up with the train, the Blue Bonnet Express. The pilot signals it to stop. They put Eisenhower on the train. It's full, they find out. There's no seats left. So he's sitting there on his suitcase. And a lawyer walks up to him and says, Colonel Eisenhower, you don't have a seat? And he says, well, no. He looks up. He says, it's actually Brigadier General Eisenhower. No, but no, I don't have a seat. And he says, well, my boss, Clint Murchison, big oil man, he's got his own car in the back of the train. Why don't you come on back? So he goes back, and he plays poker and drinks whiskey with Murchison for a couple of days, from Friday to Sunday. On Sunday, he arrives at Union Station in Washington. His brother Milton picks him up and drives him to George Marshall's office, which, by the way, was located where the Vietnam Memorial now stands. He walks in, and Marshall looks up and says, Ike, doesn't know him well. He's met him a couple of times, spoken briefly. He says, Ike, tell me how to fight the war in the Pacific. How long do I have, says Eisenhower. Marshall says, this afternoon. Eisenhower writes a 3-page memo laying out a basic strategy. You must abandon the Philippines, which means abandoning a lot of Eisenhower's old friends, because he had been the aide to Douglas MacArthur, the chief of staff to MacArthur, during the 30s in Manila. He says, you must preserve Australia as your future base, and that means you have to keep the lines of communication, the sea lines of communication, open across from the west coast of the United States down to Australia, these are your basic strategic needs. Marshall comes back, reads the memo, looks up again and says, okay, tell me how to implement it. In this one weekend, Dwight Eisenhower's future is created. Clint Murchison, 12 years later, would be the lead financier for Eisenhower's presidential campaign in 1952, in which the moderate Republican Texas oil men like Murchison supported Ike, while the right-wing nuts of Texas, like the Hunt family, the real extremist oil men, supported MacArthur, Eisenhower's old boss. So it was a real sort of, and I actually suspect, I can't prove this, Eisenhower ultimately ran for president, I think, because he feared that MacArthur might become president if he didn't. And he loathed MacArthur and knew that MacArthur really represented the strain of American fascism. So World War II is fought well with a very effective team of Roosevelt, Marshall, Eisenhower. What happened? How did we get from that to Vietnam, Iraq? Well, the big change, oddly enough, came about 6 months into the Korean War. Matthew Ridgway, who had been Marshall's lead protege, really, as a young officer, goes over to Korea and takes over about 6 months into the war, very late December 1950. He's very effective. He turns the war around in about 6 months. The first thing he does is he tells the Pentagon, I'm going to fire five of the six division commanders here. And he gets a rocket back from Wade Hayslip, the vice chief of staff of the Army. Time out, they say. We're fighting a small, unpopular war. And I actually quote this document that I found, where Hayslip writes to him and says, if you do this, have these public firings, Congress is going to start asking embarrassing questions. So they say, do it on the down low. You can get rid of these guys, but disguise it. Find a place to park them. And we're basically going to lie to Congress about what's going on. It's harder in an unpopular war to relieve people. We see this in Korea, Vietnam, Iraq. In the Vietnam War, the tradition of punishing failure is totally lost. As far as I can tell, only one general commanding a division was fired in Vietnam for combat ineffectiveness, and that was Major General James Baldwin, an entirely forgotten figure. Indeed, in My Lai, 400 Vietnamese civilians are killed, and many of the women and girls raped by American troops. The chain of command above the platoon and company involved know what's going on, and then they cover it up. They destroy the documents. This is all the Army's investigation. There's actually one hero of mine in this book is Ray Pierce, the general assigned to investigate My Lai, who does a great job, even though the division commander he's investigating is an old friend. He is shocked to find his old friend lies to him. The general who lied was Sam Coster. And this is the moral collapse of the U.S. Army. General Coster, who had presided over the cover-up of the killings at My Lai, is not kicked out of the Army. He had brought more disrespect and upon the Army. He had done more to damage the Army, I think, than any Army general since Benedict Arnold. And they didn't even kick him out of the Army. So here we come to today. Being an Army general today is like being a professor with tenure. You can do a lousy job, and you won't get fired unless you embarrass the institution with a moral lapse. So, by all means, be professionally mediocre. Just keep your pants on. That is the story of Iraq. Tommy Franks, Ricardo Sanchez, and George Casey, in varying degrees, led the war poorly. Tommy Franks spiked the ball on the 20-yard line when he got to Baghdad and thought the war was over. It was just beginning. Ricardo Sanchez had an insurgency blow up on his face in Iraq and then went and presided over the Abu Ghraib mess, which resulted from leadership failures, and then went home and bitter because he hadn't been promoted for that performance to 4 stars. George Casey did a somewhat better job, but a very conventional man trying to operate unconventionally, unable to get his subordinates to do it. To me, that is the scandal of generalship. Years of mediocrity tolerated and nobody doing anything about it. The parallel scandal is Afghanistan. 11 American commanders in 11 years. If you ran a corporation like that, it would go bankrupt. It results from inattention, from the bureaucracy mindlessly marching on, Congress not knowing how to ask the right questions, the media not understanding this stuff, and the American public not caring. 99% of the country ignores the wars, 1% fights them. Americans no longer have skin in the game, and so wars are conducted in their names, and they pay no attention. I find that morally reckless. I find that much more immoral than two consenting adults having an affair privately. By the way, I've been asked several times by news anchors and various TV fatheads, isn't this demoralizing for soldiers to find out that their commander was emailing a woman? And I said, okay, yeah. Newsflash number one, David Petraeus is a human being. Newsflash number two, Marine General John Allen, a Marine officer flirting with a woman? My God. The point of the matter is, no, soldiers are not demoralized that their commanders are trying to get laid. They understand you can fight and get laid pretty much in the same lifetime. And I think they probably say more power to them. These are guys who have done 4, 5, 6 tours in Iraq. They've had less sex in the last few years than a lot of people in prison do. Yet we wake up one day and say, my God, how could these people behave so? Soldiers are not demoralized by generals who party around a little bit. Soldiers are demoralized by generals who get them killed, by being poor leaders who don't understand their jobs, by being inefficient or combat ineffective leaders. Soldiers really want one thing in war. Anybody know what it is? What?
Not to be there.
Yeah, but they know they're there. So once they're there, what do they want? They want to get home alive. They will put up with a lot if their combat leader's effective. They'll put up with a racist. They'll put up with an alcoholic. They'll put up with a pure son of a bitch like George Patton. Because if they think that guy is an effective combat leader, and either will help them survive, or if they're not going to survive the war, at least won't throw away their lives, that their death might have some meaning. We as a country have lost hold on this. The real scandal is the mediocre generals, not a superior general like Petraeus, actually, who did operate effectively, yet after 3 combat tours in Iraq, 1 combat tour in Afghanistan, by the way, parachuting accident, smashed his pelvis, it's held together by a bunch of steel screws. He was shot through the chest in a training accident here. He and his family gave a lot at the office over the last 10 years. And when the moment came for the nation to be as generous in return, we have not been. You can see I have some feelings about this. So we have gone through a generation of mediocre generals, generals who are no longer accountable. And I think this is kind of true in public and private lives, and that's where it comes together. I think Dave Petraeus, the Dave Petraeus I've known for the last 15 years, did lose his moral bearings. But, you know, you put people through a lot of stress. And when he retired from the Army, the world he had known for 40 years, I think he may have lost more of his bearings there. We want to support the troops, right? Everybody wants to make sure we don't repeat the mistakes of Vietnam. If we want to really support the troops, not just give them lip service, we should hold their leaders accountable. Soldiers deserve good leaders, and that's the basic theme of this book. And right now, we are not giving them that at the high levels, but they're very good at the frontline level, the tactical level. That takes care of my prepared remarks. Now I'd love to get into your questions and answers. And as I understand it, because there's not a mic system, I'm going to kind of quickly repeat or summarize the questions. It's not like I'm trying to reword you. I'm just trying to go along with the rules of engagement. Please. Thank you. Please. Okay. Essence of the question is, you know, we want good leaders, but when you're fighting these unpopular wars, how do you get, you know, good people, because these are such lousy, stinky, little dirty wars? The fact of the matter is actually there's a lot of talent in the Army, and I want to emphasize that at the tactical level, soldiers are well-trained, well-equipped, and they're in cohesive units. There also are standout general officers. They're not universally bad. Petraeus was one. Lieutenant General Jim Dubik was another one. I always admired Dubik because when he retired from the Army as a three-star general, he went to Johns Hopkins to do a PhD in philosophy. Unusual thinker. H.R. McMaster, a very good officer who shows in the Gulf War, 1991, he led the tank charge in one of the big tank battles in the desert, the Battle of 73 Easting, the most utterly conventional of mechanized warfare. In Iraq, 15 years later, he's one of the first commanders to figure out how to carry out an effective counterinsurgency operation. Same guy. So a good officer, and by the way, a PhD in military history from the University of North Carolina, and wrote one of the best books on the Vietnam War, Dereliction of Duty. What made him able to do that? I would say because he is educated. He's not just trained. You train for the known task. How do I shoot a machine gun? How do I plan a tank fight? You educate for the unknown, for the complex and ambiguous, the chaotic situation where you have to go in and think critically, decide what's important, separate that from the trivia, see through the smoke, figure out what is not important, what is very important, and what is essential, how are you going to deal with it, and then, this is the other aspect of generalship, how do I get people to act on that, thousands of people. It's a very demanding task, generalship, both physically and intellectually. Not a lot of people can do it really well, and some people can't do it at all, which is George Marshall's insight. If you're not relieving about 10% of your generals, you're not holding people accountable, was his feeling, because not everybody's going to succeed. These days, being an Army general is like Lake Wobegon. The Army says everybody's above average. So there's a lot of good raw talent in there. I don't think the problem is with the actual people. I think it's with the culture and the incentive structure. An incentive structure that in World War II said, the road home goes through Berlin, through victory. Everybody's going to need to take some risk here. We're in it for the duration. Now we have a war where people rotate mindlessly in and out, 11 commanders in 11 years in Afghanistan, and don't take a lot of risk here. Don't stick your head up. Keep your nose clean and go home after a year and say what a great success you had. And if it gets messed up, say, well, my successor blew it. You're right. World War II was an existential struggle. Everybody was in it. The nation was mobilized. There was a real sense. I remember I was talking last summer, actually, to a guy who was a tank officer in World War II. And he said, you know what my greatest fear when I was in training was? That the war would end before I could get into it. We were desperate to get into it. You're right. Korea, Vietnam, Iraq, Afghanistan, small, messy wars, it's harder to know what success looks like. Yet, I can give you clear examples. Ridgeway in Korea is notably more successful. O.P. Smith is notably more successful. Dave Petraeus in Iraq is notably more successful than three predecessors. I think Petraeus' mission in Iraq was to get us out of it, and he did. Job well done. Let's do somebody way up there. Yes, please. The question is, at the beginning of the Iraq War, the Marines fired a regimental commander, Colonel Joe Dowdy, was fired by General Jim Mattis. And the question is, are the Marines different from the Army? Is there something different going on here? The answer is yes. The Marines, I think, are more in the nautical tradition. Remember, the Marine Corps is actually part of the Navy Department. And I think they've retained more of the nautical tradition of holding the skipper responsible for everything that happens on his vessel. You don't get a lot of alibis accepted and a lot of whining excuses. It's, hey, it happened on your watch, you take the hit. Yes, please. The question is, there been changes resulting in the Army from the beginning of the all-volunteer force, which, by the way, we've had for close to 50 years now, about 45, and also about contractors and the use of basically mercenaries to supplement our war effort. Yes, I think the all-volunteer force has been extremely successful, I think too successful. It's been so successful that we, as a great democracy, can wage war without paying attention, and I think that's worrisome. I actually, for that one reason alone, would like to see a draft. So I never thought in Seattle I'd get a round of applause for calling for a draft. Yeah, I mean, I had a nephew who joined the Marines, and I taught my liberal Santa Barbara sister how to say, "You got skin in the game, mofo?" Contractors, yes. I think contractors is another form of evidence of lack of professionalism in the Army. What is a professional? A professional is somebody who does not do it for the money. Lawyers do it for the money, I think, these days. But the classic professions, law, clergy, medicine, military, by definition, you couldn't just do it for the money. When you have contractors doing it for the money, it's unprofessional. Hence, I think it's unprofessional to have them on the battlefield. I think it's unprofessional for retired generals to endorse political candidates using their rank and service number. Joe Smith endorsing somebody is fine by me. Retired Army Major General Joe Smith? No. You're dragging your service into politics where it shouldn't be. Likewise, I'm appalled at the number of generals who go in the defense industry and make big bucks. Again, I think, abuse of your profession. So I was very pleased to see Defense Secretary Panetta announce, I think it was yesterday morning, that he wants a study done in the Pentagon of the state of military professionalism, because the theme of this book is it's in pretty bad shape. Let's do someone over here. Yes. Question is, why don't we hear more about a draft? Why isn't there a congressional discussion? Why, you know, the notion that, hey, if there were skin in the game, people would pay more attention. My wife's a 19th century historian, and every time I talk about restoring the draft, she very nicely reminds me, yeah, and when people tell you it's impossible, Tom, it's not going to happen, that's what they told the abolitionists, too. Abolition went from being this crazy dream to the law in about 30 years. I think eventually we will change the way we pay attention to the military, the way that Congress talks to the generals, the way we even man the force. But I think it's probably going to take a real crisis, probably a large military failure, before we sit back and say, you know, this is no way to run it. I'll tell you the nightmare. I wrote about this in my blog today. In 1938, the Royal Navy, Britain's Navy, was the world's largest. During World War II, it was almost entirely irrelevant. Why? Because it had a lot of firepower, but it was not the firepower that was needed in World War II. It was big battleships, which were useful if you wanted to, you know, shell Guadalcanal, but were no longer at the center of maritime conflict. It was aircraft carriers and submarines would determine World War II, and the British weren't very good at either. They didn't understand either. They didn't understand the role of the aircraft carrier. They underestimated how much the submarine had changed things. So I think we may wind up with a big, expensive, irrelevant military. I want to give somebody else a chance here, just to move around. Way up in the corner. Yeah, you. I think pacifism is a perfectly honorable position to take. I don't subscribe to it. Many members of my family do, which makes for interesting Thanksgivings. The nature of the world is we have seen repeatedly bad people try to do things through force. It wasn't so long ago that Hitler tried to wipe out Jews from the face of the earth and came pretty close to succeeding. So there are bad actors. There is a need for military force, but I think, and I do believe in having a strong military, but a relevant military also. That said, I think the best thing we could do for the U.S. military right now is cut its budget by about between 10 and 30%. Now, that's the Seattle I know. Because there's an old British saying, we no longer have any money, now we must think. The U.S. military has had a fire hose of cash played across it for the last 10 years. We have wasted billions of dollars. We have a generation of officers who don't know what financial austerity looks like or feels like, who are used to give me the best solution, even if the second best is almost as effective and one-tenth the cost. So I think we really need to sit back, cut the budget, and do a lot of serious thinking. The odd thing was the military in the 1930s had almost no money, and so they couldn't even do a lot of exercises, but they did a lot of education because it's cheap to sit and read books. We had a terrifically well-educated generation of generals going into World War II, Omar Bradley, Joseph Stilwell, Dwight Eisenhower. They were well-read men. Eisenhower has this image of like, yeah, I just read cowboy novels. A friend of Eisenhower's walked into his apartment in Washington in the 1920s, and there were just stacks of books about Belgium, the Netherlands, Luxembourg. And he said, Ike, what are you reading all these books for? And he said, that's where the next war is going to be fought. You want people like that in the military thinking. You don't want to go to war, but if you do, you want thinking people leading it. Yes, way up there. I think the fundamental change was bureaucratization. You know, just big organizations start defending their own interests rather than the interest that they're supposed to defend. And they start doing what they know how to do instead of adjusting and doing what they should be doing. So you go from World War II, which really was, they were insistent that we will operate in a relatively democratic way for a military. You know, this is why it was such a big shock when Patton slapped two soldiers who basically had PTSD, because it was so profoundly ill-disciplined on his part for a general to slap a soldier, but also it was undemocratic. Vietnam was operated not for the interest of the nation, not even for the interest of the soldier, but for the interest of the Army Officer Corps. Exhibit A is six-month combat rotation for officers. They do one-year tours, but 6 months were in a staff job, 6 months in command, so everybody could get a taste of combat command. This was a murderous policy, literally. I mean, I use the word advisedly. We know statistically that soldiers serving under an unseasoned commander in his first few months of command are much more likely to get killed. This is a policy that killed soldiers. But likewise, we did the same thing in Iraq. When we had mediocre generals and tolerated them, we had an insurgency blow up on our hands. When we operated in a mindless, stupid way, we had an insurgency on our hands. Now, I do admire Raymond Odierno, who I beat the hell out of in Fiasco, as a general who really did the wrong thing in his first tour in 03-04, commanding the 4th Infantry Division, came back a few years later and knew he had to operate differently and did so. If the measure of a general is his ability to adjust and understand and change to deal with the situation, then Odierno was a very successful general. But the officer corps generally, and the general specifically, start operating less and less like stewards of their profession, responsible to the nation, and more like a union or a guild, looking out after their own interest first, not upholding professionalism. So we go from Marshall, who refused to write his, he's not a rich man, he lived on his salary. Henry Luce offered to make him a rich man by paying him, like, I think it was $1 million for his memoirs of World War II. Marshall turned him down. He said, either they would be untruthful or I would hurt a lot of people's feelings, and I don't want to do either of those things. To today, generals who think it's quite acceptable to go off and make a bundle in the defense industry selling weaponry to their former subordinates. I think they have lost their hold on the sense of the military as a profession. So this is why this Panetta study is so important. Now, I have been around Washington long enough to know that you name a commission when you need to kick the can down the road. But sometimes these commissions can produce something. And if they actually do review the state of military professionalism and come to concrete recommendations about things like political endorsements, defense industry, and caring more about your career than about your soldiers, about not just giving lip service to supporting troops, but actually putting them as a priority before their own interest, that could really be good. We're getting a little bit tight on time here, right? Do we have any veterans here of our wars who desperately need to ask? Well, you already asked one. Veterans who need to ask a question who haven't asked is the first thing. Okay? It's funny, I have, you know, Westmoreland is such a laughingstock now, as we all just laugh. And I did run into a woman whose mother knew Westmoreland growing up in South Carolina. And she said, oh, yeah, my mother knew him as a kid. His nickname was Dummy Westmoreland. But he looked like a general. And this was an era when they'd lost this hold on professionalism, and they didn't really know what a general should be doing. And they picked a guy to be a general basically because he looked like a general. But Westmoreland, we wrongly remember as the primary villain of Vietnam. He was more, to use the Chinese term, a running dog of Maxwell Taylor. And Maxwell Taylor was really the officer I would blame for getting us in Vietnam. First, he's Army Chief of Staff in the 1950s. The Army doesn't know what its role is anymore. It's the era of nuclear warfare. Do we even need an army in an era of nuclear weapons? The Army's first response is, well, we're going to go nuclear too. They invent the Davy Crockett. Anybody know what the Davy Crockett is? It was a recoilless rifle, actually, but it lobbed a nuclear shell a couple of miles. And the joke was it was an intelligence test because the lethal radius was bigger than its range. So any soldier who fired it was pretty stupid. But the Army found, well, the nuclear army, that didn't really work. And so Maxwell Taylor began looking around for a new market for the Army. And he said, brush fire wars. And he really says this as Chief of Staff of the Army in the mid-50s. Eisenhower basically tells him to get lost. Eisenhower at one point says, I am not putting ground troops into Vietnam because I will not fritter away the American military on the periphery of the Communist Empire. This is when the Joint Chiefs of Staff recommended we use nuclear weapons to bail out the French at Dien Bien Phu, and only Ridgway on the Joint Chiefs of Staff objected. So Eisenhower keeps us out of Vietnam. Maxwell Taylor writes an angry book that Robert Kennedy and John F. Kennedy love. They bring Maxwell Taylor in the White House, and he says, I got a brush fire war for you guys, Vietnam. And I think that was really the beginning of lighting that fuse. Okay, last question is the two-hander. The definition of the two-hander is if you don't get to ask it, you're going to go home and mutter to your spouse or partner. You have a two-hander, ma'am. Yeah. The question is, what is the relationship between President Obama and his generals? Is he intimidated by them? Does he trust them? I think it's very complex. I'm generally an Obama fan, and I can say that because I'm not a reporter anymore. I'm a blogger with opinions. However, he worries me a bit in the national security arena, despite his success and things like getting bin Laden. I don't blame him for this, but Obama ran on a domestic agenda. He does not want to be a war president. And so all his dealings with the military, you get the feeling when he sees a general walk into the Oval Office, the general effectively is wearing a William Westmoreland mask in his face. Obama's nightmare is LBJ, great domestic agenda destroyed by a foreign war. And Obama's talked about this, how he, you know, the disaster of Vietnam and how what that did to Johnson. He does not want to be Johnson. But the problem also is neither he nor many of the people around him know much about the military or understand it. This places a great burden on our generals who have to explain to an executive branch and a legislative branch that doesn't understand military operations. When politicians don't understand military operations, they tend to treat the military not as a servant of the nation, but as one more interest group. You saw this in the vice president's debate when Paul Ryan and Joe Biden were asked by Martha Raddatz a good question where an officer she knew said he felt that the electoral process was not worthy. It was so degrading that he sort of made unhappy as an officer to be out defending this process. And they both responded by saying, don't worry, we're going to throw a lot of money at the Pentagon. That was not the question. Finally, on Obama, I am quite concerned by the narrowness of background of the people in his national security establishment. The president, the vice president, the secretary of state, and the secretary of defense are all former members of Congress. The national security advisor and the deputy national security advisor are both former Hill staffers. Now, having somebody from the Hill by itself is not a bad thing. But typically, you have much more of a mix. You have people from academia, from business. You have retired military officers. You might have career bureaucrats who have risen up through the system. I was thinking the other day about the three most effective defense secretaries I covered. And the three most effective, I think, were Dick Cheney, I said as a defense secretary, not before he... And my father had the same thing. You have a bunch of triple, quadruple bypasses, you turn into an old crank. But Cheney was an effective defense secretary, though he made mistakes like everybody. William Perry was another effective defense secretary, and Robert Gates was. Well, they all, you know, they have a mixture of backgrounds. Cheney's a politician who later works in the executive branch and then in corporate America. William Perry is an academic and a venture capitalist. Bob Gates is a career spy and bureaucrat and a natural-born killer. I would like to see more of that mixture in the Obama administration, especially because the narrowness of background can sometimes produce a narrowness of vision and a certain hubris. I've never seen a national security team with such a narrowness to it, maybe since Kennedy, when they all came from Harvard and they all thought they were smarter than everybody else, and look where it got us. I'm going to sign some books. So, line on up. Thank you.
This podcast was presented by the Seattle Public Library and Foundation and made possible by your contributions to the Seattle Public Library Foundation. Thanks for listening.